With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Danielle Leal.
Hey everyone, Danielle Leal here, and thanks for getting your agriculture news with me today. Farmers are finally getting a chance to weigh in on milk pricing at the August 23rd federal hearing. Nearly 5 years after joining the federal milk marketing order, California dairy farmers will have a chance later this month to weigh in on proposed changes to how milk should be priced, with potential impacts to their take-home pay. An August 23rd hearing was scheduled after the U.S. Department of Agriculture received an initial proposal from the National Milk Producers Federation. The organization contends that the dairy marketplace has changed substantially since the federal milk pricing system saw its last comprehensive revision back in 2000. That was today's California Farm Bureau Food and Farm News Report, and now let's get into today's show headlines. USCIS announces a new I-9 form. A revised I-9 form has just been released by the U.S. Customs and Immigration Service. Employers may begin using the new form immediately, but the pre-existing form can still be used until October 31st of this year. However, the new form will be required as of November 1st. A few of the revisions to the I-9 form include reducing form instructions from 15 pages to 8 pages by condensing and moving specific sections to a more need-be basis. The form can now be filed from tablets and mobile devices. The new form updates the list of acceptable documents page to include some acceptable receipts, as well as guidance and links to information on automatic extensions of employment authorization documentation. It also includes a checkbox allowing employers to indicate that they've examined the Form I-9 documentation remotely under DHS-authorized alternative procedures rather than via physical examination. If you'd like to take a look at the form, you can visit uscis.gov. Stay tuned as we'll have more on this topic in the coming shows, but for right now, here's AgNet West Brian German with more agriculture news.
The UC Small Farms Network serves as an information hub connecting small farms to research and education resources. At a recent meeting of the California State Board of Food and Agriculture, Small Farms Advisor Ruth Dahlquist-Willard explained the types of bilingual technical assistance and extension support they can provide.
Crop production challenges, that could be nutrient management, disease and pest management, irrigation management, so on-farm production issues. A lot of our work is with regulatory compliance with various programs. Again, thinking about how systems are set up, whether they're set up for small farms or not. Often regulatory programs might be sort of a one-size-fits-all setup, and then small farms have a harder time doing the paperwork, particularly having staff and family labor time to do the paperwork and understanding how the program works. So food safety, the Irrigated Lands Regulatory Program. Now we have SGMA, the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act, as well as pesticide safety and other types of labor compliance. And so we do a lot of assistance with compliance with regulatory programs, and particularly when farmers need support in their own language. And then also assisting farmers to apply for incentives and grants. And it's a really important thing because that's how you get access to these dollars. So since we started expanding with CUSP funding in 2021, we've assisted almost 2,000 small-scale farmers with that support, and 92% of those are socially disadvantaged or underserved farmers.
Biological materials hold quite a bit of potential for the ag industry, but there is some hesitation in implementing them in farming systems. Don Cameron from Terra Nova Ranch said more support for the sector is needed to make them more viable options for growers.
Yeah, we know that there's a lot of products coming, and as growers, we just don't have the time to sit down and test them all. It takes time, it takes money, and you've got to evaluate them, and each year is a little different too. So we're hopeful that the resources will be available to evaluate products either privately or through public agencies to really determine where we can go with this and increase adoption as we move forward. As growers, we need effective crop protection material that are going to help us long term. But we also know we have neighbors and our communities that we are cognizant of, that we don't want to create any issues or environmental issues with what we're doing in farming.
I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
Thanks, Brian, and stay tuned as we'll have more of the day's agriculture news and farm features here on the AgNet News Hour. Don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and at Statewide Agriculture News at your convenience. All you have to do is search our name of AgNet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's AgNet West. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
If your soil could talk, what would it say? If it's healthy, it may already be saying some good things about your future. Because farmers who use soil health building systems that include no-till, cover crops, and diverse species and rotations report greater productivity, profitability, and resiliency to weather extremes. Learn more about what your soil is saying about its health and your future. Contact your local USDA Natural Resources Conservation Service office today. This message brought to you by USDA and this radio station.
Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal, tossing it right on over to Sabrina Halverson with today's National Spotlight.
In today's National Spotlight, farmers have the chance to voice their thoughts on a USDA program. The USDA's Risk Management Agency is gathering feedback on possible changes to prevented planting crop insurance coverage. According to the RMA, prevented planting provisions in insurance policies can provide valuable coverage when extreme weather conditions prevent expected plantings. The agency is hosting virtual and in-person listening sessions around the country. RMA Administrator Marsha Bunger says the agency will use the feedback to provide better crop insurance options in the future.
We will accumulate them, digest them, and they will eventually be made available for public viewing. So at some point, and we don't have a date for that yet, because we'll have to get past that September deadline for the written comments, but at some point you can expect them to be made available at USDA on our website.
Bunger says she heard a few good ideas during a listening session on Tuesday.
They comment about if there's several years in a row of excessive moisture, as an example, you could possibly get out of eligibility because you're not being able to plant, harvest, and insure. To possibly look at a secretarial designation or a presidential declaration in your county as the support to possibly get a waiver so that eligibility can still continue, which I thought was a great suggestion, great feedback. So again, like I said, people think, oh, you went to a listening session, they're not going to listen to you. I disagree. Now sitting on this side of the table, farmer feedback is the best.
Comments are due by September 1st and can be submitted online through regulations.gov. In other news this morning, this summer has seen some record heat in many areas. USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey tells us the states that saw some records in July.
If you break it down by individual state, we do have four states, and those being Arizona, New Mexico, Florida, and Maine, reporting their hottest July on record. So really, it just depends on where you're at, and a lot of that heat across the southern tier, but it was also quite warm in the northeast. If you look at states that made it into the near record territory for the month of July, we'll say top 10 all time in that 129-year data set. It's a quite long list of states, mainly across the south and the northeast. Top 10 all-time rank for the month of July. The southern states that made that list, it stretches all the way from California, Nevada, and Utah, eastward through Texas, Louisiana, and Mississippi. Then as you go to the northeast, if you start with the Atlantic coast states from Maryland northward to Maine, all of those Atlantic coast states ranking top 10 for the month of July all time.
Many cities broke records that month as well.
If you break it down to individual communities and cities, we did see some really off-the-charts numbers coming in. Phoenix, Arizona became the first major American city to report a monthly average temperature greater than 100 degrees Fahrenheit. That all-time record in Phoenix, 102.7 degrees Fahrenheit, was the average for the month of July, more than 7 degrees above normal. And then we saw those all-time record, hottest month on record, if you look all across the South, extending all the way from Phoenix and Las Vegas into West Texas, where we saw El Paso doing the same all-time hottest month, and then to the Gulf Coast, cities like Baton Rouge, on through the Atlantic Coast, Miami, all coming in with their hottest month on record, with persistent heat in place since mid-June in Texas and for much of the remainder of the Deep South since early July.
That's today's National Spotlight. I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
Thanks, Sabrina. And now for today's livestock report, here's Randall Wiseman.
Well, in today's livestock news, according to new data released by the U.S. Department of Agriculture and compiled by the U.S. Meat Export Federation, U.S. pork exports concluded an excellent first half of 2023 with another strong performance in June. As for beef exports, while they were well below the record pace established last year, June exports topped $900 million in value, and that pushed the first half export value to nearly $5 billion. We'll start off with pork exports. They were almost 246,000 metric tons. That's up 12% from a year ago, while export value climbed 6% in June to over $691 million. Through the first half of this year, exports were 14% above last year's pace. A value at over $4 billion is up 12%. Pork exports to Mexico were on a record pace this year. The first half value was up 21% to more than $1 billion. First half exports increased sharply year over year to Asian region, Australia, Taiwan, the Dominican Republic, and Chile, while also posting gains in China and Hong Kong, along with South Korea and Central America. Pork variety meat exports surged 32% in the first half of the year. Now, beef exports at a little over 115,000 metric ton in June was down 12% from a year ago and slightly below this year's May volume. Export value at $909.5 million was down 13.5% year over year, but the highest since October, 4% above the value posted back in May. Now, the first half of the year, beef exports 10% below last year's record pace at a little over 669,000 metric ton. Export value was just under $5 billion. That's down 19% from a year ago, but still 8% above the first half of 2021. And after a strong start in 2023, exports of U.S. lamb muscle cuts trended sharply lower in the second quarter. June exports of just 109 metric ton were down 56% from a year ago. Value fell 45%. A complete detailed summary of the January through June export results for U.S. beef, pork, and lamb can be found on the U.S. Meat Export Federation website, usmef.org. And a new bipartisan bill introduced in Congress looks to expand access to dairy products for all program recipients. The legislation would amend the Healthy Milk Fluids Incentive Program and allow SNAP recipients to get more products like yogurt and cheese. The bill was introduced by Jim Costa and Nick Langworthy, and it's intended to boost dairy intake and support U.S. dairy farmers. The bill's title says it aims to amend the Food and Nutrition Act of 2008 to establish a dairy nutrition incentive program. Food Navigator says the bill is endorsed by the International Dairy Foods Association, National Milk Producers Federation, and the National Grocers Association. The International Dairy Foods Association says the incentives program will actually enhance the Healthy Milk Fluids Incentives Program scope by adding whole and reduced fat milk, cheese, and yogurt. I'm Randall Wiseman for Agnet West.
You're listening to Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leo. We'll be right back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
Over the years, you've brought them into your home. You were prescribed opioids after the C-section and after Dad's back injury. They helped when you were in pain, and you held on to them just in case. But did you know holding on to unused opioids puts your family at risk? Trouble with opioids can start at home with unused medicines such as pills, patches, and syrups. You can remove the risk and protect your family. Find out how at www.fda.gov/drug disposal.
You've been listening to the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Welcome back. We've got more of the day's agriculture news right now.
The American Farm Bureau Federation announces a new collaboration with the largest culinary school brand in the United States. That's coming up on This Land of Ours. Farm Bureau's Promotion and Education Committee announced a collaboration with culinary school Escoffier. Committee Chairman Darren Westergaard says AFBF and Escoffier will collaborate on farm-to-table cooking events, the annual convention, and other projects.
It will be used to help bridge the gap for consumers between field and pork and help our members to have the tools that they need to share their story and in doing so the story of agriculture.
Westergaard says the partnership brings together culinary arts and agriculture.
It makes sense for those that grow the food to be able to help teach the ones that help prepare the food. I see it educating, it's engaging, that will hopefully help members and the culinary arts students do what they need to do.
He says he's excited to see how the collaboration will grow. I'm Sabrina Halverson for Agnet West.
This is the Agricultural Law and Tax Report. I'm Roger McCohen. It's common in agriculture for children and teens to work on a farm or ranch, but there are laws that govern child labor in agriculture. Federal labor law generally applies to children under age 16 and when working in hazardous situations, but there are exemptions that apply to children working on a farm or ranch outside of school hours. For those working for their family, neither the minimum age nor the hazardous occupation rules apply. In these situations, the child can operate a tractor with over 20 PTO horsepower, operate machinery and equipment and chainsaws, work with timber, work from a ladder at a height of over 20 feet, drive vehicles, work inside ag structures, handle and apply chemicals, and move dry fertilizer. In general, age 12 is the minimum age for employment in agriculture, but younger children can be employed in any non-hazardous ag job on a small farm outside of school hours with parental consent. Once reaching age 14, a child can work any job on the farm that's non-hazardous. At age 16, they can work all farm jobs without restriction. There's basically no maximum number of hours per day or week set for work on a farm, and many farms are exempt from minimum wage requirements. In addition, a state can establish its own version of child labor laws, but many do follow the federal rules. This has been the Agricultural Law and Tax Report. I'm Roger McCohen.
And now, here's a 1946 movie scene that's set in a coffee shop. Roll that film.
I want a cup of coffee.
Okay, Mr. Black.
Just a cup of coffee.
That will be 20 cents, please.
Whoa, 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 whoa. Stop the projector. 20 cents for two cups of coffee? Wow. It's no wonder U.S. coffee consumption reached its peak in 1946, with the average American consuming that year almost 46.5 gallons of coffee. Things went along pretty well for coffee until the 1970s, when coffee consumption began to turn downward. So the average American in 1946 drinking over 46 gallons of coffee. By 2005, that was down to 24 gallons and still falling. What happened?
It's a combination. It was the use of the percolator, which is the worst way to do it.
That's Orlando Holmes, a coffee grower, roaster, and marketer. He grows coffee in Honduras. And yes, he says, first there was the electric percolator, which really took hold in the 50s and 60s. Those machines depended on boiling the water to get it to brew the coffee. Boiling is too hot and would often give you very bitter coffee. So one factor was the percolator. Another, competition from soft drinks and a consumer shift away from breakfasts.
And also the coffee companies started using more and more Robusta coffee, which was a third of the price of Arabica beans, trying to make higher profits, but they just made bad coffee at the same time.
But finally, the tide turned. A new era of coffee started to brew in the 2000s.
Some of the coffee companies made it more fashionable, and people started looking for even better coffee. 100% Arabica, well-raised, top-grade, roasted right.
He says once people tasted good coffee, demand for it started to rise, not just because of the coffee itself.
You know, it's a social thing.
This is Karen Blakesley, Extension Educator, Kansas State University.
People like to hang out with friends or meet with colleagues to have a work session and to go have a cup of coffee.
And that coffee's far different than in the past.
They've added a lot of flavors to them to enhance people's idea of what coffee's supposed to taste like.
Oh, it's a new world of coffees. I sometimes go to the drive-through coffee shop and my daughter will ask me to bring her
a hot grande caramel macchiato with almond milk.
Or maybe
a hot grande chestnut praline latte.
Well, I got to write all that down. Also, for home brewing, there are those single cup brewing machines.
That's added a whole nother dimension to the market.
And ooh, a different sound as well. So all of this is bringing coffee consumption up from a per-person yearly average of 24 gallons in 2005 to over 35 last year. However, health experts are voicing concerns.
Do you really need all that caffeine?
We'll take a look at the pros and cons of that in a future report. Gary Crawford, reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
This is the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. We'll be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports when we return. But don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search Agnet News Hour or Agnet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's Agnet News Hour. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
What GMO crops are grown and sold in the U.S.? Well, there's corn, like me, soybeans, canola, sugar beets, and cotton. typically were ingredients in certain foods. GMO alfalfa, corn, soybeans, canola, and cotton are used as animal food. And while you won't find many GMOs in the produce section, there are versions of GMO apple, summer squash, potato, and papaya in a few markets. Feed your mind with more GMO knowledge on FDA's website.
Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West, providing you with statewide agriculture news daily. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Now let's listen in to more featured segments.
Bottom line, grain analysts say don't discount the chance USDA may have a surprise in today's crop report. I'm Mark Oppold with your bottom line report brought to you by Helena. We've seen the setup before. Most observers expect a mostly neutral crop report, only to have a surprise either on the supply side or demand side. Now, NASS sent a memo out Tuesday afternoon, leaving the door open for adjustments in planted acres. Now, we don't expect a significant change, if any. And now that all the major estimates are in, corn yields ranging 173.5 to 177.5. Soybean yields 50-52.5. Corn and soybeans have shown some resiliency to hold above earlier lows, and we see a strong base established for both going forward. Livestock futures are dealing with news that Smithfield Foods closing 35 hog farm sites in Missouri. This follows news Tyson is reporting to close 4 chicken processing plants, both say due to reduced demand and declining profits. I'm Mark Oppold, wishing you a profitable day and a profitable week ahead.
Good day, everybody. Albert J. Hernandez, the Untamed Chef for AgNet West. Welcome to the California Kitchen, where you can learn how to cook from an award-winning chef in under 3 minutes or less. I'm your host with the most. Let's get untamed. So I've got a lot of people saying, Chef, we need more toppings for, you know, for fruit, for toasted granola, especially with the heat being as hot as it is right now, and it has been really, really scorching. I want to make this as simple as possible. And the fruit right now, especially the stone fruits, the apricots and the peaches and the nectarines, everything is just out of this world amazing. So how can we just add to that already beautiful product without compromising it so much? Here is a very simple recipe for making whipped marshmallow. Now, this is going to be real marshmallow, marshmallow from scratch. Now, typically when you make marshmallow, you need gelatin. But when we whip the marshmallow, we don't need to add anything to this at all. And some would even say this is pretty much on the base of an Italian meringue, but a little bit sweeter. Whereas meringue, typically what you're going to do is you're going to bake it. This we're going to eat straight. And being that this is going to be on top of our fresh fruit, this is a fantastic compliment for anyone, and it's very simple to make, so let's get untamed. The very first thing I need to do is I'm going to get my mise en place ready, and what we're going to be needing here is egg whites. Absolutely no egg yolk in this whatsoever, because it'll keep our marshmallow from, first of all, from being nice and white and nice and pure, but more importantly, it will make sure that it does not fluff up without almost scrambling egg. I know that sounds a little insane, but you got to trust me here. So what I'm going to do is I am going to take 55 grams of water, 165 grams of sugar. I'm going to put that into a small pot, and I am going to put it on my stove, and I'm going to bring it to 244 degrees Fahrenheit. Now, remember, after 212 degrees, we're getting into some really, really hot stuff. So I caution everybody to just be careful when you're doing this. Make sure you have a thermometer, because once you hit that 244, you are good to go. Now, what I'm going to be doing in my stand mixer, and I prefer using a mixer for this because the process takes 10 minutes, is to add 55 grams of egg white. And I want you to whip it by hand, and just until it starts to have some bubbles. It doesn't have to be fully a whipped egg, just a little bit of bubbles. We're going to turn it on once we hit 244 degrees, and I'm going to put this on a high, and I'm going to slowly pour in what is now a simple syrup into this mixture.
And as it starts to whip up, you're going to start to see this egg nice and shiny, the beautiful whipped marshmallow that we are making here. Now, like I said, very, very carefully, just remember this is really, really hot. Practice with extreme caution. And after 10 minutes, allow it to sit for 10 minutes and then serve it on top of any of your fruit, your parfaits, or anything you're doing. It even tastes good on top of ice cream. I know that might be a little too sweet, but it is absolutely fantastic. I'm Albert J., the Untamed Chef for AgNet West.
A 1% overall increase in U.S. drought coverage through July and into the first day of August perhaps hid that there were significant changes in drought on a regional basis month over month. USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey says of note,
highlighting that area of the Great Plains in the Midwest where we do still see some pretty high-end drought with some adverse impacts on pastures, rangelands, and summer crops, including corn and soybeans, sorghum, and cotton, depending on location.
A further look at crops and drought for the period ending August 1st starts with corn and soybean growing areas.
During that five-week period, looking at the Midwest, we actually saw decreases in the coverage of corn and soybeans located in drought. And for the most part, despite the late month heat, we did see a relatively cool and wet month of July across a big swath of the Midwest, especially the southern, say, two-thirds of the Corn Belt. It was a little drier as you head to the north into North Dakota, Minnesota, Wisconsin, but the major production areas further south did see a relatively wet month.
The numbers? 51% of soybean growing areas covered in drought, 57% of corn in drought, both down from the previous five-week period by 63% and 70% respectively.
Sorghum started off the year okay, but we did see an increase in heat late in the month, also some dryness in some of the key production areas. By August 1st, 55% of the U.S. sorghum production area in drought.
Texas cotton growers were perhaps the most impacted by drought conditions for that commodity throughout July. Yet as Brad Rippey shares the national cotton in drought figure.
Still though, by August 1st, only 20% of the U.S. cotton production area in drought. But given the importance of Texas to that national picture and the fact that some of that heat hit areas that aren't actually experiencing drought, we do see relatively low cotton conditions because of the degradation in conditions in Texas.
He also points out the correlation between expanding drought and impacts on spring wheat growing conditions late in the growing season.
As we started the month of July, just 15% of the U.S. spring wheat production area in drought. By August 1st, that number had risen, almost tripled, to 44%.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
You're listening to AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Daniel Leo. We'll be right back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
Why do you listen?
I typically listen here at work from my desk on my way to work in the morning. When we wake up, it goes on the radio.
I can hear a song and be instantly transported back to a time in my life that I enjoy remembering.
I think that's what I like listening to radio for, is just to stay informed on whether it's news, sports, new music, anything.
Why do you listen? Go to whyilisten.com, tell us why you listen, and you have a chance to win $500. Visit whyilisten.com today.
Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour. I'm your host, Danielle Neal. Farmers could quickly lose important tools to deal with pests unless the EPA acts soon. David Geiger reports more.
Farmers could quickly lose important tools to deal with pests unless the EPA acts soon. It has been 50 years since the United States passed laws to protect species nearing extinction, and yet the Environmental Protection Agency has had little meaningful compliance when it comes to pesticides. Jake Lee is Deputy Assistant Administrator for the Pesticides Program in EPA's Office of Chemical Safety and Pollution Prevention. He says noncompliance means lawsuits.
And what that means for farmers and other pesticide users is that there's a real risk that we will be forced to pull a whole bunch of pesticides off the market in a very short amount of time unless we can find a way to meet our ESA obligations.
To avoid that, the EPA has a work plan out aimed to comply with the Endangered Species Act, or ESA, creating a roadmap for the next decade. And because around half of endangered species are plants, this past month it announced a draft herbicide strategy proposing mitigation for 900 listed species and critical habitats to reduce the potential impact of agriculture chemical use.
So that we're, one, protecting endangered species, but then two, also ensuring that the pesticides on the market are completely legally defensible, that they're not at risk of getting pulled off the shelves by a court if we are sued. And that's going to provide farmers with a lot more certainty.
Certainty farmers need. Northwest Iowa farmer Brent Swart is a District 1 director of the Iowa Soybean Association. He appreciates the EPA is trying to find new ways to preserve active ingredients as opposed to
not relabeling products, which has happened in the past, and even in the past few years, which has really been taking some tools out of our toolbox and kind of handcuffed us on a few things as far as our production practices. So I like that they're trying to make an effort to conserve what, you know, the active ingredients we do have left. So that's a great thing.
Swart uses conservation practices on his land, a big part of his values.
Whether that involves soil or plants and animals around us, that we're good stewards of the land and we're leaving it better than we found it.
Lee wants to use farmer practices already put in place through a pesticide label menu. The draft herbicide strategy is designed around options on a credit-based system.
Let's say a farmer needs, I'm going to make this up, a total of 6 points on the label so that there's compliance with the Endangered Species Act. And let's say the farmer is already implementing, you know, a certain set of practices that gives a total of 3 points. Then that farmer only has 3 more points left, right, to get to the finish line.
And I think that's probably a good thing because I'm hoping that when this comes out, it will offer farmers a wide variety of options that are going to best fit their operation, rather than saying you have to do this particular practice.
That's a response from Megan Anderson, Central Iowa agronomist for Iowa State University Extension, who adds there will be challenges. Pesticide labels are often considered unwieldy by farmers, but the label is the law and a good guidebook.
It seems like we're entering a totally new realm of pesticide labeling, and we've seen hints of it with the dicamba and the 2,4-D products for over-the-top use in crop, but it's certainly not a time to get lazy with reading labels.
The EPA proposed credit system takes mitigation practices, technology, and equipment, much of which farmers already use. Swart says beyond protecting animals, pesticides are expensive.
How we set up our sprayers with seed treatments and things, trying to mitigate any off-target movement with that, nozzles, pressures, adjuvants, and things that we utilize. We want to make sure we put it where we apply it.
Anderson agrees farmers are already mitigating pesticide movement, sometimes without even thinking of it, watching for wind speeds, choosing right nozzles, and using buffer strips. But pesticide registration is a long process. Stephen Bradbury with the Iowa Monarch Conservation Consortium says it takes a lot of time. This strategy could streamline it.
So if it works, we're going to have the same levels of protection for the listed species, and farmer regulatory certainty and how to properly use the herbicides, but perhaps we can get more of those decisions done more quickly.
Bradbury says this draft lays out an approach to look at herbicides as a group rather than on a case-by-case basis. EPA's Jake Lee.
And so when we register a pesticide, or when we have an existing pesticide that we have to reevaluate every 15 years, that reevaluation or that initial registration of the pesticide triggers a compliance with the Endangered Species Act, right? We basically have to make sure that we're not introducing a new pesticide on the market that's going to harm endangered species in a way that violates the Endangered Species Act.
The monarch butterfly is not on the list yet, but under consideration by the ESA. Bradbury studies the impact of herbicides on the monarch and says there's either a direct effect, if it could be toxic to larvae, or an indirect effect, where herbicide damages habitat, in this case milkweed. Fortunately, his research shows the monarch is pretty resilient to herbicides, although some milkweed species are endangered. If anything changes, this EPA work plan could move quickly.
And to the extent the species needs some additional protections after going through these analyses, they'll be put in place. Maybe a little sooner.
Anderson adds.
Which means hopefully that these things end up in farmers' hands faster and that they're easier to be updated.
In Northwest Iowa, Swart worries this new labeling process of a scoring system creates extra work.
That's going to add more time and cost and record keeping to farmers. And so you know, that just, it adds to the list of things we need to get done in order to be effective managers, and that, at the end of the day, is not a good thing.
Anderson says newer products already have moved in that direction. A new label means more monitoring.
Probably on a field-by-field basis where they're applying whatever product it is, they're making sure that they're taking into account that menu. And then I think the most important thing is going to be, I don't know whether there are record-keeping requirements specific to this menu, but I think farmers are going to want to keep those records.
Lee thinks the credit system is the best path forward because farmers are already familiar with many types of mitigation practices.
Things can't be like how they were done 40 years ago, right? There are going to have to be some reasonable restrictions to protect endangered species. And that's really what's new.
He adds the courts have gotten impatient. In just the last year, three federal appeal court decisions displayed frustrated judges on EPA's lack of compliance with the ESA. I'm David Geiger reporting.
This is the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. We'll be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports when we return. But don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search AgNet News Hour or AgNet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's AgNet News Hour. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
You're going to need me.
You're going to need us.
All of us.
You're going to need our help with your water, your air, your food.
You're going to need our determination, our compassion.
You're going to need the next generation of leaders to face the challenges the future will bring.
And we promise we'll be there when you need us.
Today, 4-H is growing the next generation of leaders. Support us at 4-H.org.
You've been listening to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Welcome back. We've got more of the day's agriculture news right now. CDFA is accepting applications for specialty crop block grants. The California Department of Food and Agriculture is opening up the application period for 2024 specialty crop block grant program proposals. Each year, CDFA conducts a two-phase competitive solicitation process to award funding to projects that enhance the competitiveness of California specialty crops. Grant awards will range anywhere from $100,000 to $500,000 per project. Projects may last for up to 2 years and 8 months. Nonprofits and for-profit organizations, including local, state, federal, and tribal governmental entities, and public and private colleges, as well as universities, are eligible to apply. CDFA will conduct webinars on the program as well as the application process. Applicants must register online. Proposals must be submitted no later than September 7th. If you'd like to find out more information, you can always visit cdfa.ca.gov and search Specialty Crop Block Program.
The California Foundation for Agriculture in the Classroom Conference is coming up September 22nd through the 24th in Sacramento. Executive Director Judy Culbertson highlights some of the activities that will be taking place at this year's conference.
We are going to be starting our conference off with a real live Western barbecue out at a cattle ranch. And on the way to that cattle ranch, Friday afternoon, we will be stopping at two or three different farms and ranches along the way. So the teachers always really appreciate getting to see real live farms and ranches and have an opportunity to visit with farmers and ranchers. So we'll be making a couple stops and we will be then enjoying a big barbecue at our cattle ranch. On Saturday, it's going to be a really packed full day. We start out early in the morning. We have a couple different workshop sessions, and then we're going to be walking to the Farm to Fork Festival, which is being held in downtown Sacramento all day that Saturday. And while the teachers are there, we really hope that they'll have an opportunity to talk with different farmers and ranchers and kind of look at the whole process from farm to fork.
More information about the conference is available at learnaboutag.org. I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
Farmers have the chance to voice their thoughts on a USDA program. The USDA's Risk Management Agency is gathering feedback on possible changes to prevented planting crop insurance coverage. According to the RMA, prevented planting provisions in insurance policies can provide valuable coverage when extreme weather conditions prevent expected plantings. The agency is hosting virtual and in-person listening sessions around the country. RMA Administrator Marsha Bunger says the agency will use the feedback to provide better crop insurance options in the future.
We will accumulate them, digest them, and they will eventually be made available for public viewing. So at some point, and we don't have a date for that yet, because we'll have to get past that September deadline for the written comments, but at some point you can expect them to be made available at USDA on our website.
I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
Getting more farmers in carbon markets. American Farmland Trust and Sierra View Solutions released a report titled Agriculture Carbon Programs from Chaos to Systems Change. The report analyzes 22 agricultural carbon markets and recommends changes that would help these programs succeed. The challenge was underscored by Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack, who says, quote, among the many reasons why farmers aren't enrolling in ag carbon programs, one of the most obvious reasons is the offered payments are too low. Farmers also don't take part because the Ag Carbon Program did not adequately define what a, quote, new practice is, and they're setting arbitrary caps on participation in different areas. A third problem area is that carbon programs originally designed for forestry projects are being applied to farmers and create unrealistic requirements to sequester carbon for 40 to 100 years. There are also concerns about the length of time for each carbon program and data and technology barriers for agriculture. AFB contributed to that report.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit AgNet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media, at AgNet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Danielle Leal, Brian German, and Sabrina Halvertson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the AgNet NewsHour from AgNet West. AgNet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.